Chapter 42. Life is never dull around the Andrea Doria for the schools of silver-scaled fish that claim squatters' rights in luxurious cabins that cost their previous occupants thousands of lira. But nothing could have prepared the denizens of the blue twilight world for the arrival of two creatures more bizarre than any inhabitant of the depths. Their plump bodies were covered with shiny yellow skin, their backsides protected by a black carapace. In the center of their bulbous heads was a single eye. Twin stumps protruded from the bottoms of their rotund bodies. Near the top were similar shorter appendages, each ending in a claw. Most curious were the softly whirring fins on each side. The creatures hung in the water like balloons in the Macy's Thanksgiving parade. The soft laughter of Zavala's voice cackled in Austin's headset.
"Have I ever told you how much you resemble the Michelin Man? After the meal with McGinty last night, I wouldn't be surprised at anything. My gym suit is a little tight around the gut."
The Cyanic hard suit must have been nicknamed by someone with a vision problem. The so-called gym suit was actually a body-fitting submarine. The forged aluminum skin was technically a hull. Vertical and lateral propulsion thrusters on each side were activated by foot controls. With its oxygen recirculation and carbon dioxide scrubbing capability, the suit was good for 6 to 8 hours of dive time with 48 hours of emergency life support. It topped the scales at nearly half a ton, yet in water the suit weighed less than 8 pounds. The hard suit provided mobility, long dive time, and no decompression. The suit's major disadvantage was its bulkiness. Penetrating the interior following Donatelli's route would be suicide. They would become ensnared on wires or lines within minutes. In formulating a dive plan, Austin reviewed all past dives on the Doria, successful or not. Austin thought the gimbal expeditions had the right idea. The 1975 attempt tried to use a submersible for reconnaissance, but the craft lacked the power to fight the current. The diving bell, intended for use as an elevator and workstation, was improperly ballasted and went dangerously out of control. What impressed Austin was the fact that saturation divers working from the surface with umbilical hoses managed to accomplish a great deal against formidable odds. They actually got into the garage. The 1981 gimbal expedition was better prepared. The bell system worked well. Although it ran into all sorts of problems, including nasty weather and a current that tangled the umbilicals, divers managed to find the safe and hook it up to a crane. In the end, Austin chose a combination of hard suits and saturation divers. He patched together an expedition relatively well equipped for the task. His father provided the monkfish and crew. Gunn combed through the Numa expedition and ship schedule and pulled together the diving bell and a decompression chamber on the deck that was equipped with showers and bunks. The borrowed mini-sub, with its recon capabilities, was an unexpected bonus. Most important were Numa's 6 experienced saturation divers who were flown in from Virginia. Since their arrival on the Monkfish, they had worked in round-the-clock shifts to cut a hole in the liner's hull. The weather on Nantucket Shoals lived up to its reputation for changeability. When Austin and Zavala crawled out of their bunks that morning, the air was transparent. The lumpy sea of the previous day had vanished, and the ocean was mirror calm, reflecting, like polished glass, the images of the seabirds dotting the surface. A pair of black fins cut the water. Dolphins. McGinty said they were a sign of good luck and would keep the sharks away. The surface current was about 1 knot. He predicted that a thick fog would later work its way onto the shoals, and the current might come up, but they could deal with that. Encased in their heavy suits, the Numa men were lowered by crane into the water. They spent several minutes just under the surface checking out their gear while the crane again swung out over the water and dropped a Kevlar cable that was ganged into 4 short lines ending in sturdy metal clips. They gripped the line firmly in their mechanical claws. With a hum of vertical thrusters, they descended into the Indigo Sea. The monkfish was locked in place exactly over the wreck by four anchor lines, two at the bow, two at the stern, 100 meters in each direction. Stability was crucial. Otherwise, the diving bell would swing at the end of its tether like a pendulum. Although the hard suits were equipped with lights, and they brought portable lamps with them, no illumination was needed. The visibility was at least 30 feet, and the shadowy outline of the ship stood out in relief against the paler bottom. They headed toward where a section of the hull was illuminated by a cold, pulsating glow. At the center of the eddying bluish corona, two saturation divers clung to the upended port side of the ship like insects on a log. One diver knelt on the hull with a cutting torch in his gloved hand, while the other tended the carry cable that conveyed the fuel and kept an eye on things in general. They had been transported down earlier by the diving bell, which served as an elevator and underwater habitat for the dive team. Suspended by a thick cable that ran to a winch on the deck of the monkfish, the bell hung a few meters above the hull. It was shaped like a gas-powered camp lantern. The four sides were rounded slightly at the corners. The roof sloped down from the hole for the hoisting cable. Another cable containing communications and power entered the bell from a lower point on the roof. Fastened to the outside were tanks holding breathing gases and torch fuel. The bottom of the bell was open to the sea, which was held in abeyance by air pressure. From the opening, umbilicals snaked to the divers, carrying the breathing mixture and hot water to body-warming tubing in their Divex armadillo suits. In addition, each diver carried an emergency breathing tank on his back. The divers were working on a section of steel plating that had been scraped clear of anemones to expose the black hull paint. The heat discoloration from the magnesium rods in the high-pressure feed oxy-arc cutting torch outlined a large rectangle around the garage doors. The saturation diver who'd been tending the torchman became aware of the twin yellow blimps approaching. Using the slow-motion movement that comes with working in deep water, the diver reached up to take the cable from Austin and Zavala. The Numa men could communicate directly with themselves and with the salvage boat, but there was no direct link to the saturation divers except through the bell. Austin was unconcerned because everyone had gone over the plan many times, and hand signals were adequate for all but the most complicated message. The kneeling diver snapped off his torch when he saw the new arrivals. He pointed to each corner of the rectangle where he had cut double holes and gave the thumbs-up signal. Then he and his companion attached the clips from the surface line to the holes. The divers moved several meters away, and one made a jerking motion with his hand like a locomotive engineer pulling the whistle cord. Austin radioed the deck crew. "All clear. Start hauling." The deck crew relayed the message to the crane operator, and the Kevlar line went as taut as a bowstring. Seconds passed. Nothing happened. The framework around the door had been cut like a dotted line on cardboard. Austin was wondering if more cutting was needed when there was an explosion of bubbles from the deck. The section pulled free with a muffled boom. Austin directed the surface crew to move the crane over and let the doors drop onto the hull. A huge, gaping, rectangular hole had been opened in the side of the ship at the B-deck level. The tourist-class cabins had been stuffed into fore and aft sections of this deck and C-deck, the level below it. The forward section of deck was where the cabins were split by the Autorimessa, the deck that housed 9 cars and an armored truck. Zavala powered his suit so he was directly above the newly created opening.
"You could drive a Humvee through this thing."
"Why do things halfway?
Think of it. Everyone who dives on the wreck from now on will think of this as Zavala's hole."
"I'll pass that honor on to you. How about naming it Austin's Aperture?"
"How about scouting things out?"
"No time like the present."
"I'll take the point. We'll go nice and slow. Watch out for ceiling cables and collapsed bulkheads. Remember to keep a safe distance apart."
Zavala didn't need to be warned.
The hard suits resembled space suits worn by the astronauts. As with astronauts floating in freefall, motions had to be deliberate and unexaggerated. Even at slow speed, a collision between the 1,000-pound suits would rattle their teeth. Austin moved in under Zavala so that the light from his suit pointed straight into the ship. The powerful beam was swallowed by the darkness. He gave his vertical thrusters a short blast, descended feet first into the garage, then stopped and rotated the suit 360 degrees. The water was free of loose ends and projections. He gave Zavala the all-clear and watched the bloated yellow figure sink through the blue-green hole and come to a hovering stop.
"This reminds me of the Baja Cantina in Tijuana," Zavala said. "Actually, it's not as dark."
"We'll stop for shots of Cuervo on the way back," Austin replied. "The ship is 90 feet wide. The cargo would have slid down to the bottom, like Captain McGinty said. Everything is at a 90-degree angle, so the floor of the garage is actually that vertical wall right behind you. We'll stick close to the wall so as not to become disoriented."
As they descended, Austin went down a mental checklist, anticipating obstacles and reactions. While he worked on practical problems and solutions, his brain was busy on another, irrational level, probably the survival mechanism that raised the hackles on the unshaven necks of his ancestors. He was hearing Donatelli's voice describing his terrifying descent into the innards of the ship. The old man was wrong, Austin concluded. This was worse than anything Dante could have imagined. Austin would take the fire and brimstone of the Inferno any day. At least Dante could see something, even if it was only demons and the damned. It was hard to believe now that the decks of this vast empty hulk once throbbed with the diesel power of 50,000 horses, and more than 1,200 passengers basked in the ship's sensuous beauty, their needs served by a crew of nearly 600. The first person to dive on the Andrea Doria after she slid beneath the Atlantic said the ship seemed still alive, producing an eerie cacophony of groans and creaks, the banging of loose debris, water rushing in and out of doorways. Austin saw only decay, emptiness and silence, except for the sound of their rebreathers. This huge metal cairn was a haunted place where a man who lingered too long could go mad. The ship seemed to close in on them, and Austin kept checking his depth gauge. Although they were only about 200 feet from the surface, it seemed deeper because of the darkness. He looked upward. The blue-green rectangle that marked the opening was diffused in the murk, and eventually might have become invisible if the saturation divers hadn't placed a strobe light on the edge as a beacon. Austin glanced at the blinking pinpoint and felt reassured, then turned his focus to what lay below. Under their feet, solid objects were looming out of the darkness into the circle of illumination cast by their lights. Straight lines and edges, mysterious rounded shapes, tons of debris were jammed into the horizontal space that had once been the starboard bulkhead of the Doria. When the ship was leveled, the garage was covered with heavy metal mesh and catwalks. Now these were vertical as well. Austin and Zavala started a search pattern, moving in parallel lines back and forth between the vertical partitions formed by the old floor and ceiling of the garage, the type of search they would execute if they were on the surface looking for a shipwreck. They encountered dangling wires from the old light fixtures, but not enough to be dangerous, and they were easily avoided. Their lights caught the glint of metal and glass and vague forms that occasionally resolved into familiar shapes.
"Hey, Kurt, is that a Rolls-Royce I see down there?"
Austin directed his light at the distinctive heavy grille sticking out of the debris. "Probably. According to the liner's manifest, a guy from Miami was shipping his Rolls back from Europe."
"Goes to show it pays to have a Rolls on every continent."
Austin glided over the Rolls and saw part of another car with unconventional sweeping lines. "That looks like the Chrysler experimental car built by Ghia. Too bad Pitt isn't here. He'd go through hell and high water to add a one-of-a-kind to his collection. He'd have to go through a lot of mud, too." The cars had tumbled on top of one another and now were largely covered by debris and silt. Austin had briefly entertained thoughts of a plan to excavate the debris, but it was an intellectual exercise only. Too dangerous, costly, and time-consuming. Any effort to dig through the cover would store up a cloud so thick it would take days to settle. From what Donatelli said of the truck's position, the vehicle should have fallen onto the top of the heap. It should have been visible. Could the old man have been wrong? He was under tremendous stress that night. Maybe the car was in another cargo hold. Austin groaned. It had taken a tremendous effort to cut into the garage. They had neither the time nor resources to try again. His expeditionary force was made up of assets borrowed for only a few days. Doubts grew the longer they searched. They went over every square yard of visible debris. "Whatever happened to the plan to refloat this thing with ping-pong balls?" Zavala said. "I don't think there are enough ping-pong balls in China for the job. What's your take?"
"I think Angelo Donatelli was one gutsy guy. This must be the biggest sensory deprivation tank in the world. Hard to believe we're still on planet Earth. I feel like a fly in a molasses jar. I'm beginning to wonder if the truck is in here at all."
"Where would it be?"
"I wish I knew," Austin replied. "Nina is going to be disappointed."
"I know.
What say we go topside and deliver the bad news?"
"Fine with me. My bladder is telling me I drank too much coffee this morning."
They powered the vertical thrusters, keeping a slow but steady pace, homing in on the flashing beacon above. As they ascended, they flashed their lights ahead and above to make sure they weren't coming up on unseen obstructions. The beam from Zavala's light stabbed the blackness in a corner of the garage, moved away for a second, then came back.
"Kurt," he called out excitedly, "there's something in the corner."
They stopped their ascent. Austin saw two red eyes glowing in the inky darkness. Having spent more than an hour in this otherworldly environment, his first reaction was that they were looking at a huge sea creature who'd made the ship its lair. He pointed his light at the twin orbs, and his pulse rate ratcheted up a few beats. It couldn't be. Both men moved in for a closer look and put the full force of their lights on the corner.
"Well, I'll be damned," they said in unison.